Welcome to Into Africa. My name is Mvemba Pezo Dizolele. I'm a senior fellow and the director of the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. This is a podcast where we talk everything Africa, politics, economics, security, and culture. Welcome. The world is confronting several contingencies, including transnational threat, climate change, and demographic pressures. Africa is not spared. In fact, some of these threats are as prominent in Africa as they are elsewhere. In Africa, the United States deploys several tools and instruments in its foreign policy arsenal to deal with these issues, including the United States Agency for International Development, the Millennium Challenge Corporation, the Development Finance Corporation, and the United States Africa Command, AFRICOM in short. Headquartered at Kelly Barracks in Stuttgart, Germany, AFRICOM is one of the 11 unified combatant commands of the United States Department of Defense. It is tasked with addressing security threats to the United States across Africa, except for Egypt, which is covered by the United States Central Command. This is a vast area of responsibility, including 53 countries. AFRICOM is currently led by General Michael Langley, the first black officer of four-star rank in the United States Marine Corps. The command undertakes a variety of missions, such as training, support, and combat. Joining me today on Into Africa is Ambassador Young, the deputy to the commander for civil military engagement at United States Africa Command. Good morning, Ambassador Young, and welcome to Into Africa.
Good morning, Mvemba, and thank you for welcoming me here to CSIS and Into Africa. It's really a pleasure to connect with you and also all your listeners who spend so much time and so much energy and bring so much vitality to the questions of concerning Africa every day.
It is our honor, truly, Ambassador. Last time I saw you was in Rome. AFRICOM was hosting the annual Conference of African Chiefs of Defense, which was a huge undertaking. And I think the agenda was equally substantial and covered a lot of issues. Today, our audience and, of course, me are very interested in hearing about why you came to Washington all the way from Stuttgart and what's on your plate.
It's really a pleasure to be here, and I'm here for a particularly important reason. Yesterday, we met together at the Africa Strategic Dialogue. This is an opportunity where the senior leaders from the entities that you described, the U.S. Agency for International Development, Dr. Monde Muyanga, the Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at the State Department, Ambassador Molly Fee, and as you just said, the Commander of AFRICOM, Lieutenant General Mike Langley, got together with a number of key partners in that 3D construct of development, diplomacy, and defense, coming together and coordinating our approaches so that we're mutually reinforcing and addressing the challenges and the opportunities that present to us in Africa.
There have been a lot of questions about AFRICOM. 15 years after the command stood on the continent, that is, people still wonder what is AFRICOM and what does it do?
AFRICOM will be celebrating the 15th anniversary of full operational capability next year. We're a teenager of 14 years old. And over that time period, we've evolved a lot as we work to advance our partnership with Africa. I am the 7th deputy to the commander for civil military engagement. And the structure of AFRICOM, I think, is critically important for your listeners to appreciate. So we have General Langley, our four-star commander, and you outlined his role in leading this command. But we have two deputies. So we have my role as a senior civilian, an ambassador, a diplomat, who's the deputy to the commander for civil military engagement, and then my counterpart, Lieutenant General Kirk Smith, the deputy commander for military operations. And together, that shows this triangular leadership of employing diplomacy and defense as we work together to advance our partnership with the African continent. And it's critically important also to note that we have a senior development advisor from U.S. Agency for International Development embedded in the command, along with a large number of partners from the State Department and USAID that are embedded in each of the directorates that work at AFRICOM. The reason I share a lot with you, Mvemba, is that as we look to partner with Africa to address the challenges and opportunities on the continent, we always try to do that through this 3D lens of development, defense, and diplomacy together.
Is that traditional way all the other commands work?
No, in fact, we have a sister command in Southcom, Southern Command. They have the same philosophy, but they're less developed in this approach. Southern Command also has a senior civilian in the command structure, but no other command has the intense investment in 3D engagement of the largest number of foreign policy advisors from the State Department embedded in the command, the large number of USAID development professionals embedded in each of the directorates. And I think we place a great deal of attention to making sure that as we address challenges and opportunities, we do that through that 3D lens.
AFRICOM is a combatant command. AFRICOM does not have its own troops, if I understand correctly. AFRICOM is unique in so many perspectives. Why is it so? Why would the United States create an entire unit, an entire command for Africa, but then make it so different from the others?
So, Mvemba, let me link that question to our origins and the statement that Secretary Blinken just shared recently on his engagement in South Africa. Secretary Blinken talked about Africa shaping the future of the global engagement and the importance of African agency in addressing both challenges and opportunities on the continent and global challenges and opportunities. That is what we're trying to do with our command. Everything we do for our strategies to be successful have to have partnership at the very core of what we do. There's one motto that we have employed in the past that talk about how together with African partners, we achieve common objectives by, with, and through each other. And I think that model is one that's critically important for sustainability. We're what's called in all the combatant commands an economy of force command. As you noted, we have limited resources. We're 0.3% of the U.S. military personnel. We're 0.3% of the U.S. Defense Department budget. We're modestly funded and we're modestly staffed. But we also have a command that's three times the size of the continental United States. 53 countries, all their diversity, all the sovereign concerns of those 53 partners all need to play a role as we try to accomplish objectives of common interest. And so in order to do that, we take a page from the partnership manual. We work together with partners. You cited earlier the Millennium Challenge Corporation. I've had the privilege of working through Millennium Challenge compacts in the past, where a country to qualify for MCC needs to meet the criteria as you've outlined in your show in the past, a scorecard of 20 areas that help promote development. But once a country's selected for a compact, how do we proceed? We establish joint coordination mechanism, partnerships to decide where we're going to invest that money. And I think that model, that philosophy is what guides the U.S. Africa Command as we develop strategies to address the challenges facing the continent and our common interests.
So in your position, you are a civilian with a track record as an ambassador. You've served in various capacities and positions. What is your role at AFRICOM as a civilian in the military command and why you have this role?
When AFRICOM was established, we wanted to make it a command that had different perspective from other combatant commands. We wanted to focus on partnership and we wanted to focus on diplomacy and accomplishing objectives with our partners. So my role at the command is perhaps twofold. I've spent 30 years or so as a diplomat. I started as an intern at our U.S. embassy in Bangui, Central African Republic, longer than I'd like to mention. So I've had a great deal of professional experience working with Africa on issues of common concern. Military professionals who come to AFRICOM often don't have that historical perspective. And so the foreign policy advisors and what I offer this command is that context, that ability to work with partners from Africa on issues of common concern. I think that's one of the big contributions that someone in my role gives to this command and also gives to our efforts. We're trying to work together with our African partners to address these problems. And I think that we do that based on a solid foundation of common understanding, then we're much more effective at creating sustainable solutions.
There are a number of contingencies that the continent is grappling with. I mean, it's not the same across the continent. And we will do a robin round of these issues, starting with the Sahel. How does the AFRICOM command engage with that region, which is kind of the epitome of the various challenges, but also opportunities? You talked about partnerships. We talked about diplomacy. Starting in Ethiopia, really, and all the way to Guinea, you have a series of coups or protests or something. Yet AFRICOM, this is really kind of the beachhead for AFRICOM. How do you read that development in that region?
So thanks for that question, Amin, but I think you are correct that this is an area of focus for AFRICOM with our partners on the region. First, before coming to AFRICOM, I spent 7 years in a row in the Sahel. I was in Mali as the deputy chief of mission and also chargé for about a year. And then I was ambassador in Burkina Faso for about 4 years. And then after that, I came to join the team at AFRICOM. I have a deep appreciation for the challenges that the people of the Sahel are facing today. And I just wanted to share with your listeners how much the partners at AFRICOM express solidarity with the populations that are suffering from the expansion of violent extremist tactics, horrific attacks on the civilians and on the military professionals that try to stem the tide of this rise of violent extremism. What we are doing at AFRICOM is we're looking very carefully at that region and investing in partnerships. So, for example, since 2017, the United States has invested about $600 million in security assistance and development to try and fill critical gaps that our security force partners face. In that same period, we've invested about $2 billion in that same region, broadly in West Africa, in development assistance, invested also about $2.2 billion in humanitarian assistance. And I think that ratio is critically important. One is the humanitarian needs are growing greatly, which is resulting in the U.S. taxpayer and the U.S. citizens investing and responding to those humanitarian crises. And our development elements are also much larger than our security investments. That drives to a key element of our strategy in the Sahel. Governance, democracy, the connection between the population and the government, those are critical elements to resilience towards the violent extremist organizations that are trying to drive wedges in society, trying to break down the social cohesion that is such a wonderful element of the Sahel that I've come to know and love for so many years. And I think that that's what we're trying to get after. Right now, the United States Africa Command is working with our partners in the region, in members in the states of the region, and also international partners to develop a revised approach towards the developments in the region to help stem the tide of this horrific rise of violent extremism and displacement of populations.
The Sahel is interesting for a number of reasons. I want to linger a little bit on foreign security assistance, because that's an area, not only AFRICOM, it's an area that many donor countries are engaged in. And I wonder what you think of this idea that our team here at the Africa Program at CSIS has been working on, is that it's time for us to, for the world that is, especially donor countries, to review the model we use with our foreign security assistance. That is, the traditional approach has been military to military, government to government, just the way countries operate. But at the same time, that model has certain assumptions. And the assumption is our military works this way. That the military is probably similar to us. It's a Republican army. They represent the interests of the people and they should not invade their neighbors and so on. So that model seems to be a little bit antiquated, because in reality, across the continent, and the Sahel is one example since we're talking about the Sahel, the armies are not Republican armies. That's one. Sometimes it's the army of the north, sometimes it's the army of the south, sometimes it's mostly Muslims. But then typically these armies also do not represent the people in the traditional Republican way. So we are left then with this cooperation where in the military, we used to call this beans, bullet, and band-aid, where we measure certain things. We measure sorties of aircraft, we measure fuel spent, we measure how many Malian or Burkinabe officers we train. But in the Sahel, we see the limits of that, right? So in a place like Mali, Mali is kind of the epitome of the, everybody's Mali, AFRICOM, European, the French, the Russians, but yet we don't see peace break out. So is it time for us to bring more, and you as a civilian with your experience, is this time to bring more civilian voices at a design level of our foreign assistance package so that we don't end up apologizing to the chief when the village is inadvertently bombed? What do you think of such an idea? Security is a public service. We don't typically talk about security as a public service, but it is, in the same way we provide for water, for electricity. And if we look at it that way, then the end users are the civilians, not necessarily our traditional partners who are the military.
As we look at the drivers of vulnerability to recruitment and the incidents that have been cited by those who have joined violent extremist organizations in the past as what was a precipitating factor, many say that abuses by security forces have been the precipitating factor to those young people electing to join a violent extremist organization. And we acknowledge that in U.S. Africa Command. Every partnership training program that U.S. Africa Command does with our partners starts with the rule of law of armed conflict. We start with human rights training. We set the baseline because that connection between a professional military and the population, we believe, is critically important to this role that they play in defending their civilian population. So that's my response to that. We try to make sure that that's the key point. Secondly, in terms of what are the institutions within most of West African society that are most respected in public surveys, oftentimes it's still the military. I appreciate your point about a Republican military that's connected to the population that they're charged to protect. And that's a theme that we try to reinforce in our engagements with the sovereign nations that recruit their militaries. And let me pause and switch over to the elements of society and governance that make that linkage between the military and society. So as I mentioned before in our investments in West Africa, the predominant investment is in development. It's in things like the pillars of a democracy, an independent judiciary, a free press, civil military societies, the voice of civil society. And so many of the themes that the U.S. government writ large has invested in those two countries you mentioned, Mali and Burkina Faso, have long been in both development so that people have a prospect for a better economic future and also the voice in their own governance. And those are some of the investments that the United States helps make to enable and strengthen civil society. I would close this point with one theme. It seems that we have the rise of violent extremism in West Africa and Sahel. This is very clear. But a lot of that is because democracies have been fragile, they've been weak, they've been vulnerable. And I think investing in strengthening those democracies is critically important. And lastly, I would say one thing about the number of actors who are trying to contribute to stabilizing the Sahel. United Nations, bilateral contributions, regional contributions. Those are actors who are operating on the assumption that our common interest is in stabilizing the Sahel and assisting the populations. You also cited the Russians. Here I have concern that I think the motivations are fundamentally different. For a private military corporation like Wagner, sustained chaos is good for business as they can continue to extract resources, fund their team. But we have seen, as we saw in Mozambique, when the going gets rough, the Wagners of the world pull out in the middle of the night and run. What the international community and the United States, AFRICOM, and other partners are committed to is helping support a stable Mali, helping support a stable region, and working together with partners to accomplish a common objective.
In the case of Mali, some of the points that you've made, Ambassador, very relevant, but I have a question. You know, Mali, you talked about support to institutions beyond the military, because I still believe like the military should take a secondary role to what they've been given in those regions. They've been too much at the forefront of a lot of issues. But the question I have is, Mali was the flagship of democracy in the region. And I was a big fan of Mali. As a columnist at UPI, I wrote a lot of, I believe in Mali. But during those periods, it was a decade and a half or so, started with a coup, and then the military transitioned to civilian rule. The report out of State Department were great, no political prisoners, all the stuff that, the red flags that we often read, Mali didn't have those. But what Mali did not get was the full support from donor countries to strengthen the democracy. Are there any lessons that we've learned from this?
So I think you are right that our assessment of Mali's democracy during that period was more fragile than we anticipated. And I believe that during the period after that coup and the restoration of government when Ibrahim Boubacar Keita was elected, that a good portion of our investment from the United States Agency for National Development was through an institution called the Office of Transition Initiatives. And our investment included a big surge in helping strengthen the constituent elements of democracy. We helped in programmings for a free and independent press, for the voices of youth groups and women's groups and constituent groups to be able to mobilize and share their views so they're connected in that democratic process. So we invest in that time period in trying to support the pillars of a democracy. But it's fragile. I think we all have to look at the fragility of democracy and how much easier it is to destroy something than it is to build it up. And I think that that's going to have to drive us as we continue to move forward to make investments. One last point, will, national will is so critically important to strengthening a democracy. So, for example, if someone is in the outskirts and they're selling fuel to whom they know is a violent extremist organization, that's not demonstrating the sort of will that's connected to the civil society and to the national interest. Everyone has a role to play in strengthening the society, and the vast majority of that will, I believe, is with the sovereign nation and the sovereign population, and our job is to help enable, as outside friends, those processes.
The period you're describing is a later period to the one then I'm referring to, because I'm referring to the 90s,
yes.
Like early 91, 92, when
Atete,
they ushered in the Alpha Conaré. There was really what we call in French, essor diplomatique, essor démocratique, essor. And I think the West or the donor country missed an opportunity there to strengthen the Malian experience. Because by the time Ibeka came, it was late. The thing was already kind of crumbling. You know, the fault lines were there. By the time even Atete himself as a president had lost the support that he once had. But that's just something I want to bring. The other area is the pressure of climate change and the influence or impact on security. We see this in the Horn. We see the drought, the fifth once in a lifetime drought. But we saw Somalia still Somalia with all the conflict. We hosted the President Mahmoud here a month ago or so, his vision of Somalia. We saw, he talked about his vision of Somalia and so on. But we see what's happening in Ethiopia. On one level, there's this entire challenge to the very nature of the Ethiopian state. We see Tigray, we see Oromia, we see all these frictions so that even if Tigray is resolved tomorrow, there will be other conflict in Ethiopia until they resolve the very fundamental question about what kind of state should Ethiopia have. We leave that to Ethiopians. But for us here, how do we engage? How does AFRICOM engage in a space like that? There's the GERD. The GERD, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, a subject of great pride in Ethiopia. I was in Ethiopia last year. Everywhere in Addis, it seemed like every car had the bumper sticker that said, "It's my dam!" exclamation point. So they built it, they funded it, they conceived it, they're proud of it. But it's built on the Nile, which is not just an Ethiopian river. It's a common river to Sudan, to Uganda, to Egypt. So all of a sudden we see a situation where this is supposed to be a good thing. It's going to increase electricity output and energy and so on for Ethiopia, but it's causing serious distress in the neighborhood. What is your read of a situation like this? Are the stuff we'll be getting into going to the future? There will be more of these cases.
I would say that one of the points you laid out in terms of the political structures and the political challenges in Ethiopia are issues that Ethiopians themselves have primacy to address and resolve. We, as interested and helpful partners, want to help support them. So the United States is helping to support the dialogue. We have a special envoy for the Horn of Africa. Ambassador Mike Hammer is working every moment of every day to help enable those dialogues to be an outside voice to facilitate the reconciliation between the parties. So that's kind of what we can do as international observers and partners. We try to do that as well with the other issues that you've raised. For example, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, its interest with its other neighbors, with Sudan and Egypt and others, try to talk with them as well through this process to facilitate a dialogue and a negotiated solution to the issues that these parties bring to the table. The Alfashaga zone as well, we're trying to support conversations between the partners so that they can come to a negotiation settlement. I think all of that is what is an appropriate role for an international partner and a neighbor, and that's what we try to do. I did want to recognize as well that the climate change issues that you started with and also the horrific violence that's ongoing in Ethiopia, their continuation is in no one's interest. And I feel a great hurt for the populations that are suffering by this ongoing conflict. And so that's one of the themes that the U.S. whole of government is engaged with to try to facilitate a resolution. One, we've had our administrator for U.S. Agency for National Development, Samantha Power, engaging directly. The United States government has committed another $2 billion in emergency assistance. We've been negotiating as much as possible to be able to facilitate the entry of greatly needed humanitarian aid to those populations that are suffering. So those are some of the things that we can use, we're using our bully pulpit to encourage a negotiated settlement to this issue. And that's what we're doing each and every day, particularly under the leadership of Ambassador Mike Hammer and the special envoy for the Horn of Africa with his partners.
The climate change issue pops up across the continent. One area is Mozambique, which made the list of Global Fragility Act countries. Mozambique drives a lot of attention, particularly in the greater north, meaning the global north here where we're sitting. there's an insurgency in Cabo Delgado. There is a large quantity of oil reserves and natural gas reserve. One element that doesn't make it as much as I wish, because it's gonna affect everything, and I think it's already affecting everything, is the element of climate. Mozambique's located at that crossroads of monsoon, typhoon, cyclone, and all that. So every so often we see this violent climate event, driving people to trees, women giving birth in trees, and it just seems to be missing there. Something I want to just put on your radar there, especially with your background. I'm not sure how we're computing that into our foreign security assistance.
Thank you, Mvemba, for citing the Global Fragility Act and the strategies that the United States is developing with our African partners in 7 of the 9 countries that were designated under the Global Fragility Act to create strategies to prevent conflict and promote stability. Mozambique is a key leader in that program. And we're working together with our Mozambican partners to develop together 10-year strategies to address these problems. 5 of the others are in the coast of West Africa and also Libya. So AFRICOM and our partners in the 3D lens are looking to use these new tools in partnership to address these issues. And I think that there's a great deal of engagement in Mozambique to address those issues that undermine stability. On the security front, the U.S. is investing to support international and regional engagements to promote security in the Cabo Delgado region that you've cited earlier. And so I think it's appropriate to see that we have the SADC, the Southern African Development Council, sending forces to help a neighbor. There's Portugal that has deep ties there, and the European Union Training Mission helping to support a security response to the violence by the extremists of the Cabo Delgado region. There's also bilateral contributions from countries like Rwanda. And what we do, the United States also engages in regular training programs with those forces that are confronting violent extremism in Mozambique. So we've got a security element, we've got a development element, all done in partnership to address those issues in Mozambique. The other theme you raised is climate change. How critically important. And as you're talking about how it's affecting Ethiopia, the Horn, you said the 5th year of drought, which is putting that population at great risk. We've launched the U.S. Institute for Peace, multiple conferences on climate change. And then as we move forward, every one of our military teams in the field will be developing country coordination plans with our African partners that incorporate climate change as a key element in our efforts. AFRICOM has surveyed the vulnerabilities to climate change at our facilities so that we are aware of what the impacts of climate change can be. And then we're enabling our partners who have vast amounts of data from National Geospatial Agency to share that data collected over decades with our African partners so they can see these trend lines and see how we can develop responses to those trend lines. I would close that point with one quick trip back to West Africa and the Sahel. You're a big champion, I believe, of the Great Green Wall. And I do know that that's an investment that is making some progress in various places. They think they've accomplished 15% of the plantings that are designed to help stem the expansion of the desert into agrarian areas. And I think that those are the sorts of ways that we can continue to invest over long term the problems that have occurred over a long period of time.
The Sahel Alliance is one. We host the EU Sahel Summit here. This is our, I think next year will be our 4th iteration. And the U.S. finally joined that group, the Sahel Alliance, I think, which is probably down your alley with development package and so on. But I recently met a group of development specialists who work in the Sahel. None of them ever heard of the Sahel Alliance. I don't know if it's a communication problem, but we know the Sahel Alliance exists. But yet people on the ground did not know what it was. So I just want to flag it there in terms of communication. It may not be the purview of just AFRICOM, but in the larger scheme of U.S. diplomacy, I think there's a gap there.
Vemba, you're absolutely right that the United States has supported the Sahel Alliance. Our lead for that is the U.S. Agency for National Development. But I think you're getting at another key point, which is communication and how we're communicating. If you think about how partners are communicating what they're doing in Africa, I don't think we're doing an appropriate job to tell the story of investment. So for example, on the fight against COVID, the United States is the largest donor in the fight against the expansion of COVID. 170 million doses, for example, were gifted from the American people to 43 African countries. But I don't think that's the perception in Africa about who is partnering with them to address this problem. But I think we have a better story. For example, when I was in Mali, we had the outbreak of Ebola in the region, the coast of West Africa. We're currently facing another outbreak in the East. The United States had invested in over decades to develop Malian capabilities to manage pandemic disease. So when first Ebola cases came into Mali, our Malian partners were prepared. They were able to limit, with our support, the number of fatalities from Ebola in Mali to 7. That's an investment over decades. The Malians were able to develop their own capacities to manage the expansion of these diseases and contain it and address the problem. So I think that's the sort of long-term investment that the United States makes in Africa that's not a story that's well understood. Most of our investment, for example, is in health. PEPFAR. How many billions have we invested in PEPFAR that have saved 20 million lives? But I don't think that's fully appreciated in the African continent.
The PEPFAR story definitely doesn't make it where it needs to. One element is demographic pressure. So youth, the median age in Africa is 19. I just returned from Senegal and Morocco with colleagues. We're doing some research on migration. We get a sense that the greater north, the global north, donor countries are using a very militaristic approach to addressing migration and demographic issues. We seem to be paralyzed by lack of imagination, maybe lack of creativity. There are walls, there are drones that are causing more problems, actually. If you take ECOWAS space, where there is a definite free movement of persons and goods, somebody from Niger who's in Ghana is totally within their right. You know, somebody who's in a pirogue, in a canoe off the coastal waters of Senegal has not broken any law yet. But yet, you have a strong presence of this European through Frontex trying to stem, they will say, to stem the flow of migration north. I'm just framing that to say we have an issue here that can serve either as a challenge, or I would like to think as an opportunity, since you were mentioning opportunities, Ambassador. And AFRICOM in that space, because it's intersection of development and security, I'm not sure what AFRICOM has been thinking about that space.
When I think about African youth, the first word that comes to my mind is opportunity. I have met so many dynamic young Africans who are addressing the challenges in their neighborhoods and their communities. And I've also met with some of the ones who were able to participate in the Young African Leaders Initiative. Dynamic, problem-solving, creative people that have a lot to give to Africa and a lot to give to the globe. You talked about investments. The United States Agency for National Development, for example, invests about $30 billion a year in its programming. $11 billion of that is in Africa. And a lot of that is in investing in sustainable development. The sorts of, not as much as it should be, but a lot of it's investing in helping those populations reinforce positive quality of life in their homes. And I think that that is the bulk of our investment in Africa. I think that there are challenges as well for how to manage this growing youth population in a way that emphasizes opportunity and education. If I had my magic wand that would enable us to invest more, I would focus on education, particularly education for girls. You know that President Bazoum of Niger is a staunch advocate for education for girls and how that contributes to developing a country. So I would ask for more resources in that area, more partnership. We have some great programs through the United States funds. We have programs, for example, that the United States gives 1/3 of the money to keep kids in a school lunch program. A local government contributes another 1/3, and then the neighbors, the local community, contributes 1/3. Isn't that the sort of model that I think shows a common interest in education? I'd love to see more of that as we address the demographic dividend that's rising in Africa.
I think an increase in that space, an increase in the funding and engagement will go farther than all the militarization of this space, especially, this is a message I think your European partners need to hear a little more, because they, in the case of Africa, they're much closer to it. So I think there's a lot of frustration in Europe about this issue, but I'm not sure from what we saw on the ground that this is the best approach they're taking so far. On this program, we talk about minding the gap. We mind the gap. In every situation, there is a gap. The gap is between the reality and the perception of that situation. AFRICOM has been around 15 years. However, AFRICOM has faced some other big obstacles. I remember when AFRICOM was first launched And General Ward was trying to explain what that was. And for 2 hours at the Council on Foreign Relations, it was difficult. People didn't walk out of there like convinced, like, we see this thing. It was challenging. And this is us here. People on the continent have difficulty grasping what AFRICOM is. Then the gap is left to be filled by conspiracy theories, by all kinds of things. How, if you had that magic wand you were just talking about, how do we bridge that gap?
So I'm going to pull the magic wand out one more time in Vemba, and I'm going to say that I would encourage us to do a better job to explain that AFRICOM is a partner institution with the people and governments and societies of Africa to help stabilize their countries and promote a better future. We do that through a lens that involves development investments. We do that in a lens that involves civil society. We do that in a lens that promotes professional militaries confronting violent extremism. We do that in a lens of promoting negotiated settlements to the conflicts that arise between populations. And I think that is where we have one of the gaps. There's one other gap in Vemba that I would close with, and that is we look at Africa and all too often we focus on the difficulties, the crisis, and there are many. We talked about the crisis in the Horn, the impact of climate. There's the conflict in the Great Lakes that is rising. We've got the Sahel that we talked about quite broadly. We didn't talk so much about the North as those countries navigate a path to a better future and the challenges there that are rising that are critically important and where we need to continue to make our partnership known. But I would say that we fail to fully appreciate the progress that we've made. We fail to fully appreciate the opportunity that Africa represents on the global scene. I think we fail to represent the voices of Africa in global institutions. And I would just cite another example. But there's always the joke, what is the most dangerous animal in Africa? And the answer is the mosquito, right? Because of malarial deaths. Well, with malarial vaccines, 75% effective in under five, that was jointly developed with the United States and our partners in Africa. That's an example of how we're making progress. I love working with African partners. I love working on Africa. I love working with my development, my military and diplomatic partners. But I appreciate that Africa is a complex continent with so much variety, so many challenges, many sovereign decisions. And I love that old proverb that says, I think I'm probably going to misquote this, but, you know, wisdom is like the baobab. No one person can wrap their arms around it. I would say Africa is a baobab continent. No one person can wrap their arms around it. But when we work together, particularly when we work together in this construct that includes development focus, a diplomatic focus, and a security focus, I think we have a better prospect for accomplishing those objectives of a stable Africa where people can pursue their natural desires for a better life in the future. So it's really a pleasure to be with you, Mvemba. And also with a thank you to the listeners who are always engaging in deepening our understanding of Africa and deepening our partnership with Africa.
Ambassador Young, it's been a pleasure having you on Into Africa. Thank you.
Thank you, Mvemba.
Thank you for listening. We want to have more conversations about Africa. Tell your friends. Subscribe to our podcast at Apple Podcasts. You can also read our analysis and report at csis.org/Africa. So long.